We live in a dynamic world. The world around us is constantly changing, and our challenge is always trying to find the most advantageous choice to make at any given time. The problem is, because the world is changing, the choices we make at one moment in time might be advantageous, but then the next moment, they may change. So when we began to look at what we wanted to do with being able to be in the motion capture lab and look at some of the data there, we began to wonder, well, how can we show what happens when people have to learn one thing and then the world changes and they have to learn something else? So our motivation was to figure this out, look at the dynamic world and figure out how humans are adapting to that world from moment to moment and how, over time, we make decisions or we make new strategies for making decisions that reflect a more advantageous strategy when we have very sparse information about what that most advantageous choice might be in the long term. So at any given moment when we make a decision, it could be really a good decision or really not a good decision. We don't know. We're only getting reward or lack of reward or maybe no reward in that moment. But at any given time, the choice we make may be less advantageous. The choice we make may be less advantageous. The one that gives us reward may be less advantageous. And the one that would be most advantageous doesn't give us reward. There's this constantly shifting dynamic. So it's an important question to try and see how we can make a predictive model for this type of environment that we live in. There was an experiment we chose which had a learning paradigm, required to learn a task, which I will show you in a minute. Once it was learned without the subject's knowledge, the probabilistic rewards were shifted so that the person did not know but then had to relearn the task. It was a kind of a gambling task. So the question we wanted to know was, what is the pattern of learning and relearning? And when that changes, how did the pattern of learning change when the reward changed? How would the person know that the reward was changing? How did they adapt their behavior? What did they do? What is the relationship between the components of the response? The responses that they had to make required seeing a stimulus, initiating movement, and making a successful choice, or making a choice. The two components we looked at was the moment that they saw the decision up until the moment they initiated movement, which we thought would be very interesting. And the second part of the choice was from the moment they initiated movement until the moment they touched the screen. It was a touch screen sample. So we divided the decision-making process into these two components and wanted to see, well, do these things vary over time? And the last question we asked was, do computational reinforcement learning models relate in any way to this behavior that we were able to observe in the subjects? So the experiment was a rewarded reinforcement self-paced learning. And the task was, at any given moment, a subject would see two images. One of these images you see along the top, I don't know how to make this work. There. These are the four images they would see, or they would see it with a blank screen. The blank screen was a non-rewarded image, and they knew that. So they would see these images for 1,000 milliseconds, two together or one with a blank. Then the payouts were probabilistic in terms of each one of these images would pay. One would be 100% payout, 75% payout, 50% payout, or 25% payout, and this was no payout. The problem is you weren't paid out at every single trial. Then there was a 2,000 millisecond interstimulus interval, and the feedback was based on whether or not they made an advantageous choice in that particular moment. Now, again, you might have one of the images be the most over long term be advantageous, but the other one might reward in this particular trial. So it was sort of a difficult task to learn. The only way you could do it was trial and error learning. The immediate feedback they got was a tone, which told them you got a payout or you didn't. The payout was 7 cents if they earned, if they won, and zero if they didn't. There were two blocks of 256 trials, and they got an inter-block message about how much they had earned so far. And then you're proceeding to the next screen. It was self-learning tasks, so they had as long as they wanted to make the decision, and they would only get the next trial when they advanced to the next image and made their decision. So this is what it looked like, and we will show you a video so it's not so confusing, but the first display they got was this blank screen for 2,000 milliseconds. They got an image like this, either a reference image 60% of the time, which was with a blank non-payout image, and 40% of the time they got the actual choice, which was rewarded based, again, on the probabilistic, what the probability of payout was for these two images. There was a jitter between the reward time and the actual image of anywhere between 50 and 100 milliseconds, and then that ended when they made the decision right here. So the stimulus itself would go off after 1,000 milliseconds, but the choice time was unlimited. This is what it looked like.
So I think we're getting two good either.
So there's actually sound, but yeah, whenever they pick a right or favorable image, there's a little tone. Yeah, it doesn't really reach, but that's all right. It's just a beep. So that's okay. So all right. So when they completed that task, David did a lot of this, analyze this data, and this is the end result that you get. So as the trials proceed, you can see that their accuracy goes up, and then when halfway through they switch the probability, so an image that used to give you a reward 75% of the time would now give you a reward based on 25% of the time. And you can see, so they sort of learned, they're getting the hang of it, but then halfway through that task is switched, and then the accuracies, they have to relearn the task. So we wanted to now fit this into a reinforcement learning model. The way that works is that you assign a value to each image. We have four images. I'm going to use the words image, state, and value function somewhat interchangeably. So for each particular trial, we have to compute the value for the image. The way we do that is by increasing the Q values using this update rule. So notice that if they pick the favorable image, so if they pick image K, the value for that image is increased by alpha. But if they didn't pick that thing, then it'll be zero. So that the reward is based on 0, 1. The other images were not the images that they didn't pick weren't updated. So this term here is called a prediction error, and that's going to be important later on. Also, the choice model that we have is meaning that the image that they pick is based on this softmax function, and the parameter here is beta. So these equations that I just showed you have two important parameters, the learning rate and this exploration or exploitation rate. Basically, you have to fine-tune these parameters for each individual so that you can have a good fit. Now, remember that there are two phases in the experiment. So the question is, should we have a different set of parameters for each phase? So that would look like this. So you would have an alpha and a beta 1 just for the first stage, for the first 256 trials, and then a separate alpha and a separate beta for the second set. And the question is, which model do you use? So we fine-tuned the parameters, did a grid search on all these parameters and compared and contrast this complicated-looking thing with this simpler guy, and when you do the likelihood comparisons, you can see that this I call the first model the choice model, and this the two-phase choice model. You can see their performance is about the same, so we just kind of stuck to this. Now, and you can see that for that model that I showed you. The landscape of as you change the learning rate and the exploration exploitation rate changes like so. The bigger these, the more red these values are, the better the fit. And when your exploration is low, it's you're doing entirely exploration, and when you're very high, you're doing what's called completely exploitation. And these are all just log likelihoods. So an interesting question is, well, what if in that previous model we were only updating the state of the image that was chosen by the subject? The question is, well, what if you update the state of the image that wasn't chosen, but it was shown? So we wanted to consider this model, see how this fits. And now we have another couple of parameters to fine-tune. And when we do that, we can see that, again, the results aren't that different. So you can still use the two-parameter model as opposed to the one that requires three parameters to tune. But then let's even go more exhaustive than that. Well, what if you also account for the images that were not shown? So we're also updating the states of the images that weren't shown here. And if you look at the results, again, they both tend to behave the same. So now we're sort of being skeptical. Well, like, I mean, can anything work? Like, I mean, is there anything that'll work really poorly? So we have this thing called the junk model, where you don't update your states for the image chosen or the image shown but not chosen, but you only update for the image that's not shown. So we're hoping that if you do this, you're going to get bad results. And actually, we do get bad results. So that's good, meaning that, you know, there is these models are doing something. By the way, random performance is down here somewhere. So this is almost, it's a little better than random, but you know, some of these guys are just doing it random. The model just captures the random behavior. So, and now I'm going to transition to more.
So Madan has talked about the computational model. Now I will continue with the human behavior model. And besides the accuracy pattern that in learning and relearning that we have seen before, response time is another interesting factor to looking at because it can reveal several interesting things about the human behavior when we're looking at the pattern of how the human respond during their learning and relearning, as well as the relationship between the response time pattern and the accuracy pattern. And here we use motion capture data to extract our concern factor, the response time, because most of you in the bootcamp program have seen this face-to-face motion capture system at the Poisner lab. So yeah, just quick recap that in this system, they can track robustly and accurately the 3D position of LED markers. And the one advantage of using this active LED marker compared to some other motion capture system that use a reflective ball marker is that it can track the ID of each marker. So the reason that we choose to use the motion capture to extract the response time instead of using like the touch screen, if you remember from the clip of the experiment that after the stimuli appear, the subject will move the hand and touch the screen to choose the right choice, to choose the image. And we can use the time that the screen is touched and time between the stimuli appear and the time when the stimuli is touched, the screen is touched for the response time. However, the doing it that way is not very consistent because of the sensitivity of the touch screen. And also using that time between the stimuli appear and when the screen is touched, we cannot discriminate between the response time, the reaction time, and the movement time. So in fact, the reaction time we compute is the time between the time period between when the stimuli appear and then the subject start movement, and the movement time is the time period between when the subject start movement and then they reach the destination. And that kind of reaction time is somehow related to the brain, the time that brain process in decision making, while the movement time is the time of actual motor movement. So what we did is that we analyzed the velocity of the marker at the fingertip using motion capture data. So as you see here, the black plot is the velocity extracted from the motion capture data. And the lower green bar is when the stimuli appear. And this kind of information we already had in the motion capture data. And what we want to extract is the when the subjects start their movement and when they stop their movement. And as you see here, there are two peaks in each trial. So between this and this is one trial. And there are two peaks here because you see the subject start movement touch the screen, that's one peak, and then they retreat to the rest position, that's another peak. And what we want to determine is the first peak, and then we determine when they start the movement and when they stop the movement. And as the simple equation show in the previous slides, the reaction time will be the time between the stimuli appear and when they start the movement. And the movement time is when they the time period between when they start their movement and when they stop their movement. So to do this, we use the first derivative of the velocity, and because to deal with several type of noise here, we need to combine that with some threshold in detecting the mass, and then go into the right side and the left side to detect the start and the stop time. In fact, I want to say that this part is an important part in our intended analysis, and it also took a considerable time to do. However, I will not go into that detail here because there are more interesting things to talk about in analyzing the output of this step. So that's what Samir will talk about next.
Thanks, Song, for wonderful explanation of really technical details. So now let's see what the results look like from this analysis. You would actually expect that once subjects have learned a task, that there would be no variability in the amount they take to physically move their arm to make the decision. But this is what we saw. So what we have plotted is the movement time, which is the green graph, I hope you can see that, and the reaction time across trials. And remember, we had 512 trials, and they had one set of probability distributions over images till the midway point, that was 256 trials, and after 256 trials, we just flipped the reward distribution. So the blue line reflects the amount it takes them to make a decision as to which image to choose, and the green line depicts after they have made the decision as to which image is more valuable, how much time it takes for them to reach and make their choice final. So you can see as they start learning the probability distributions of reward, their reaction time drops. So that means they're becoming more confident about their decisions. And movement time drops pretty quickly, and it just plateaus. So, I mean, you can see that this is a floor effect or ceiling effect. But right after the reward probabilities are switched, you see this rise in movement time and reaction time. Now, reaction time, we would predict that because what they have learned before is not applicable in the new situation. But movement time, I mean, they have already learned how much, I mean, you just have to do this and do that. But once the reward probabilities change, the movement time goes up as well. So what we are thinking is going on is that not only they are taking longer to make their decision, but they're also using the movement time to fine-tune their decision. So they're more hesitant in actually moving and touching the picture on the screen. And there is this interference. This is one of the first things we noticed. And also notice that the peak of the movement learning happens much before than the peak for the reaction time learning. So they fine-tune their motor commands much faster than they fine-tune their mental distribution of reward probabilities. Next, I just talked about that. I'm sorry, I forgot that I had that in the slide. As I said, relearning rates are different for reaction time and motion time. And looking at another thing we looked at was response and rationality. Now, we categorized trials into two kind of choices that the subjects made. One was, which was a rational choice, in which they picked up the image that would have mathematically given them a higher probability of reward, and the other was an irrational choice, which was the picture with the lower probability of reward. And we separated out the reaction time for these two kind of choices. And we found out that when subjects made the rational choice, their reaction time was much higher than when they made the irrational choice. So, and this was highly significant. And the conclusion that we drew from this was that people make rational choices slower, or rather, since the subject pool was a bunch of undergraduates, that undergrads make irrational choice faster. The second part of the story was movement time. We also looked at movement time, and we didn't find any difference between when they made a rational choice and an irrational choice. And it's up for interpretation. We are going to make tall claims about that, but I'll just leave it for a little while later. Third thing we looked was the prediction of the prediction error between the reinforcement learning model that we chose and subject's performance and their reaction time. And this is for one subject, and you can see that there's kind of okay level of correlation between the prediction error and the subject reaction time. You can see these bumps here, not so much action going on here, bumps here, bumps here. We tried to look at the correlation, but there was a lot of intersubject variability, and the correlation was barely not significant. But probably with more subjects, you might see the significance. So now it's time to make tall claims. First one is that we did some work in reinforcement learning models, and they turned out to be good, but there's still room for improvement. The second one is that prolonged deliberation was significantly correlated with rational choice. The third one, which is a moot point, was that motor learning was faster than cognitive learning. As I said, this is a tall claim. You might disagree with that. There might be other things happening there, but we at least think that something of this order might be happening. Fourth, which we are pretty sure of, is that the subjects use movement time for decision making during relearning phase, but not initial phase. That might be due to various reasons. One obvious reason is that they're fine-tuning their decision, making sure that what they have chosen before they started movement is actually valid. And the fourth was that we observed interference during relearning, because if you observed during relearning phase, the learning rate is not so fast as the original learning. So once they have learned the initial probability distribution probability distributions over reward, they have to unlearn that and incorporate the new information into their belief system. So these were the conclusions that we drew. Future directions would be to analyze the reaction time and motion time with EEG signals from the motor area and see if there is any correlation or prediction that we can make. The second would be to examine the relationship between jitter and decision making. The jitter would be the third derivative of velocity, and see if there was significantly more jitter when they were making irrational choice or when they were making rational choice. It might be even more interesting to see this form of analysis in subjects that have some form of motor disability, like Parkinson's. The third would be, obviously, to consider other reinforcement learning architectures. There's a lot of improvement in that area. So with that, we conclude, and we would like to acknowledge Dave Peterson, who's in the audience, and the members of Motion Capture Lab, Gary Cottrell, Andrew, and rest of the people. Thank you. And that's about it. Thank you. Questions, yeah.
So I was wondering if maybe acting irrationally might still be sort of rational in this paradigm. I forget what time you use, but is it possible if they just responded quicker, they might get more reward per minute?
No, that was not the case. They were just rewarded at the end of the trial, and there was no incentive for them to move faster.
Okay. The other question I had is I was wondering if the finding that the faster trials were the less rational ones, is that true for individual subjects, or could it just be driven by the fact that some subjects were just in a hurry to make a response and those subjects weren't paying much attention?
I don't have
an analysis, so it's possible.
Okay, just curious.
So that was the t-test was a, you know, repeated measures t-test, so I don't know if that answers your question. Probably not.
Can you say what the heck is going on at the end? Could you go back to the graph showing the yeah, no, one more. Oh, I missed all this. Wally was out playing with another dog. So what's going on here at the end where the reaction time is going way down and the movement time is going way up?
Here?
No, at the very end.
This part? Oh, that's, yeah, at the end, we actually smooth the whole time series using a moving filter. So that is just an artifact of that smoothing that we did.
Okay, that's good, I guess. I don't show it, though. I had another question. So how would you test the hypothesis that they're using the movement time to make the decision? I mean, that's your interpretation, but
yeah.
It's just a hypothesis.
One would be to modify the experiment. I mean, with this experiment, I'm not sure whether we can test that hypothesis. This is just giving an idea that that might be the thing that might be happening.
Well, so one thought is, I mean, when they're right, they're going to go directly. When they're sure,
yes.
They're going to go directly.
Yes. So
when they're not so sure, they may shift direction.
Yes, we did look at that. Actually, we did not. That was one of the things we could have considered, but we did not analyze that. That it did happen. Dave told us that some of the subjects they actually did this, as you just said. You know, they would go here and then immediately turn here. And when we were analyzing the time series of changes in X, Y, and Z coordinate, they came out as artifacts. So right now, all this analysis is just removing all the artifacts and making the data clean so that we can get to the gist of what is happening. But a second level of analysis would be to actually look at these artifacts and see in which cases they actually change their decision midway and analyze that.
Yeah, yeah, they're not really artifacts, right? They're
mixed with, I mean, it could be, there were times when...
You mean your software decided they were artifacts?
Yeah, but there were times when the fingertip was occluded for some reason or just wasn't captured by motion capture system, and you would just see these huge spikes the system didn't capture it. So it was mixed in there with the artifacts, I would say. So we have to separate that. We looked at that, though.
Okay.
I have two questions, but the first one's on this slide, so let's do that. So for the humps that you get after, like, the 256th trial, I guess, for the movement hump, you were saying that, and then the decrease, I think the hypothesis that you put forward was that it's motor learning, but the fact that there was a hump was due to kind of cognitive uncertainty in decision-making and making some decision. So would it be possible that the reduction in the hump is simply reducing your uncertainty in your movement speed first, and then you see it continue reducing through the reaction time later?
You mean uncertainty? So what do you mean reducing the uncertainty?
So you have, like, you're still making your decision, right?
Yeah.
And that's the hypothesis why the movement hump goes up. And I'm just suggesting that the reason the movement hump starts going down is because you're reducing your uncertainty and making that decision through your motor reaction first and then through your reaction time later.
So you're suggesting that they're not using the movement time, they're not using the movement time to fine-tune their decision.
They are using the movement time to fine-tune their decision, and once they start getting more certain about their decision and they don't need to, they don't need as much time to make that decision, they speed up their movement time before they speed up the reaction time.
That could be a possibility.
Yeah.
That's a possibility.
The second question I had is just a little speculative. If you go to the second to last slide, I think, with the model versus... Yeah, this one.
Yeah.
It looks like the model prediction error is a bit oscillatory, and mm-hmm. Something like that's been seen in ADHD, that due to attention just changing over time. And I was wondering if you have any idea why your model produces behavior that looks relatively oscillatory.
Well, yeah. this is just for one particular subject. Other subjects don't show this oscillatory effect that you're talking about. And they sort of do have qualitatively a core, like they look, the two curves sort of look similar. So I don't think it's a result. I don't think the model is behaving oscillatory, but I think maybe the subject is behaving oscillatory.
Yeah. Because it's an error between the model's prediction and what the subject did. So.
That's the model's, the error between the model and the subject, or the error?
That's the prediction error of the model.
Right, okay, thanks. Because that looks great. Do they all look that good?
Not really.
Not all of them.
No. Some of them. We actually picked out the best one. As I said, you know, the correlation was not significant. It was 0.05, so 0.05 something. So.
Okay, we have to move on. It's time for the next team. Thank you very much.